Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that. And find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps, because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though most of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science, with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill discuss how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. The veteran biotech executive also shares his thoughts on how to keep things innovative at a company that's been around since the 1860s. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can find this episode and many more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts.
At Popular Science, we report and write dozens of science and tech stories every week. And while most of the stuff we stumble across makes it into our articles, we also find plenty of weird facts that we just keep around the office. So we figured, why not share those with you? Welcome to The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week from the editors of Popular Science. I'm Rachel Feltman.
I'm Perpita Saha.
And I'm Corinne Iozio.
Corinne, you're here, and that can only mean one thing.
It is digital edition o'clock. Woo. Almost quite literally, the spring issue went live this morning, mere hours, minutes, seconds ago, depending on when you're listening to this and when you might have gone to popsci.com and been like, oh, there's an issue. It's called messy. I'm messy. My life's messy. Maybe my desk is messy. I wonder what this is all about. And that's what we're here to talk about. Lots of really fantastic stories in there about what I call problem-tunities, what we can learn by staring at the messes we make and the good things that we can make out of them.
Yes. Listeners, for those of you who have forgotten or have not yet learned, The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week is a podcast brought to you by Popular Science, which is also a magazine.
Ooh.
Yeah, and the messy issue is super fun. I mean, I love every issue. Corinne Perpita and I are all extremely involved in creating these quarterly magazines, and so each one holds a special place in all of our hearts. But messy, it's been a long time coming. It's a theme. It's a theme we've wanted to do for a while.
Yes, and it is gone. This is now actually the story that I'm going to talk about is probably one of the reasons that we refused to let this issue go.
Yes.
This theme. and I'm really excited to talk about it.
To pull back the curtain, Messy was originally going to be an issue in early 2020. It was going to be called Oops. And we thought, maybe it's not so good to have a playful issue about oopses at this time. But messes still exist, and they still need to be cleaned up. And that's what this issue is about. So, on The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week, we start by offering up a little tease that we found in the course of reading, writing, reporting, scrubbing our kitchens, and decide which one we just absolutely have to hear more about first. Then, once we've all had time to spin our little science yarns, we reconvene and decide what the weirdest thing we learned this week actually was. Corinne, why don't you start with your tease?
I want to talk about why marine biologists are really, really, really into a very particular kitchen scrubber.
Ooh. So one of my favorite stories in the magazine. It's also, we'll get into it, but it's very pretty in the magazine. So if you're gonna access the digital edition, which you can do on Apple News Plus or Zinio, go to popsci.com to figure out how. Tuffy is definitely alone makes it worthwhile. It's like a 90s Polly Pocket fever dream, that art. I love it.
It's tremendous. We'll talk about it.
My tease is that I want to talk about pooping in space and how it used to be like a really big problem. And it's still kind of a problem. More complicated than pooping on Earth, for sure. I guess that's all I'll say. That's my tease.
I can't imagine pooping on Earth is already so complicated.
That's the problem I started out this journey with. We'll get into it more, but
sure.
Pooping's not always easy, no matter where you are. Perbita, what's your tease?
I'm going to tell a story about why accidental chocolate rivers are public hazards.
Oh.
And when I mean chocolate, I mean real chocolate, not
right. Poop. No, that's good. Yeah. Thank you for
yes, that's clarifying.
Well, why don't we start? Well, I'm trying to think. What do we want to start with? I feel like the chocolate one is not.
I want to separate the chocolate and the poop if right. we can. Yeah.
Yeah. Why don't I get. Well, how quickly do we want to gross people out for real, though?
Let's Mine start is not, with the definitely chocolate. Not gross, and yeah, it's let's, also
we'll
pretty
ease
short.
Into it. Let's start with the chocolate. Start with something delicious.
All right. Well, this story starts in a very humble German town, and Rachel, I was thinking that I should have run some of these German words by you and your spouse, Oliver, but alas, I did not, so sorry to all the German files out there. I'm going to butcher this, but the town is called Westoner. It is pretty much off the map, kind of on the northwest end of Germany. I think the closest big city would probably be Ham. And the sad thing is, if you look up Westoner, both in news and images, all the articles link to one specific incident, and it happened in December of 2018. It was a few weeks before Christmas at the Dreimeister chocolate factory. So I particularly didn't recognize Dreimeister. I think it's really just a kind of German specialty chocolate company. I don't think you can buy it here in the U.S., but their products look delightful. They make these beautiful, like, gold-wrapped chocolate discs look far better than the trash M&Ms I eat on the daily. but they have a small little factory in Westoner, and a couple weeks before Christmas, they had a valve malfunction in one of their storage tankers. And that meant all the liquid chocolate that was being held in this tanker, which was not too much because it was a small factory, maybe about like 2,000 pounds a ton.
Oh, is that all?
I imagine a river to be. Go ahead.
No, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was not going to say anything of import.
I mean, I'm not saying that like that's not a lot. I'm not saying that it's not, you know, in the grand scale of chocolate production, probably a small batch. Like if we're talking about like an explosion at the Hershey factory, it's different. But like 2,000 pounds of chocolate is a lot.
Yeah, it's still a lot. And especially if it's a small, like, family run company, that was probably a big chunk of their chocolate material. Well, anyway, so it leaked out of the tank and went right into the streets of Westoner. And the thing about chocolate is that it's a very tricky chemical process to both harden it and melt it. And Westoner, you know, its climate is pretty similar to us here in New York and New Jersey. In December, it would have been 20, 30 degrees Fahrenheit, especially at night, So as soon as that chocolate hit the street, it hardened. And it was just like 2 inches of chocolate shell lining the streets of this little German town.
Wow.
So as I can imagine the children in town just being like over the moon about this, but the adults, not so much. Basically, the entire firefighting crew for the town and volunteers from neighboring towns had to come out and tackle this chocolate infrastructure calamity. And they had to basically just take out shovels and like hack away at the chocolate until they could like peel off the pieces from the street. They also took blow torches to it and just like burned it to a char. So it ended up being a lot bigger of a mess than expected. And all the whimsical headlines just like probably didn't capture how annoying of an incident this was. But the cutest thing to me was the Dreimeister factory manager. The one quote that all the news stories had from him was like, well, at least it didn't happen on Christmas because that would have been a real crisis. Which is, that's definitely a silver lining if you want to see it that way.
And just looking at the picture of it, which Pravita shared with me and Rachel yesterday, it looks almost just like road surface, the way that it just goes smooth and hard, like on top of the asphalt. It's just, looking at it, you're like, yeah, that really looks like a pain.
Yeah,
it's a second road, but it's chocolate.
You know, I could not make chocolate harden that well if I tried. Like, I've watched Bon Appetit Test Kitchen. I know how difficult it is to make chocolate do what you want it to do.
Or even just trying to handle chocolate in an everyday kitchen scenario and knowing what an unbelievable mess you make, even if you're really good at it, which I am not. It's a disaster.
One time I was making ganache at a friend's house and I accidentally dropped the bowl. It was real.
Oh no.
it was a kind of just a to scale recreation of what happened here. It was pretty pretty mortifying for me.
But get out with the garden trowels and
we didn't need the fire department. We just needed my friend Claudia's dad. Help clean up their beautiful home.
And the reason chocolate is so this process is called tempering, getting chocolate. Well, the thing is, when you're cooking with chocolate, you have to heat it or cool it to multiple temperatures to get it to the texture and consistency that you want. And the reason for this is cocoa fat. So the problem with cocoa fat is that it's like very complex structurally. So when it gets cold and when it crystallizes, it can take any of 6 different shapes, which is actually really interesting and fun to read about. And there's a lot of cool like molecular chemistry research on this. So I definitely encourage readers to do that. But there's one particular crystal that culinary artists really go for, or even people just making ganache at home. And that is called Form 5 or Beta Prime, which is just such a funny name for a chocolate crystal. But that is the crystal that gives like that smooth, shiny finish that you see in like a good bar of chocolate. But to get there, you really have to, like, you can't heat your chocolate too fast, which is pretty much what I always do. And it just, like, once you do that, like, you can't put liquid chocolate in things. It just, like, gets really, really gross. But then you also can't cool it too fast. Like, it's a very fine, like, range of temperature that you need. And it's not that high either. I think it's, like, something between, like, room temperature or even higher than room temperature, like high 80s to like low 90s that you need to start with, and then you raise the temperature from there. Not a process that I have finessed, that is for sure. But yeah, I was curious to see how many chocolate leaks there have been worldwide. I do not have a hard stat for you, but just a month after the Westoner incident, there was another chocolate spill in Flagstaff, Arizona. This was not from
the chocolate capital of the Southwest, clearly.
Yeah, I don't actually know. So it came from a tanker truck. I don't know where the truck was coming from or where it was going, but it was holding liquid chocolate again, heated to a precise 120 degrees Fahrenheit. And the truck got, you know, the driver just got into an accident and the tanker flipped over. Luckily, they were okay. And I think about like 4,000 pounds of chocolate ended up on this highway in Flagstaff, Arizona. And this time, because it's Arizona, it actually did not harden. It was just like kind of sludge that the local like public safety teams had to clean up. And it seems like they actually had a pretty good time with it. There's some good tweets from the local Flagstaff officials where, you know, they're just grinning through these messes of chocolate while wearing hazmat gear. So something I would volunteer for is cleaning up chocolate off an interstate.
I just would worry that it would turn me off of chocolate, right? Even just the word like, oh, it didn't harden. It was just sludge. My insides went,
yeah, chocolate sludge. I mean, again, like, comes back to how much we should appreciate tempering chocolate, because the texture of the chocolate we eat and love is because of that, you know, beautiful cooking.
I wonder what the stage is. I wonder what the stage is when it's like the chocolate's a little bit too old and it sort of gets that dusty sheen on the bottom of it. I don't want that one. But I'll eat it anyway.
When I was a teenager, I talked my parents into getting a little like tabletop chocolate fountain for special occasions. And the thing is with those, you need to use candy melts because it needs to be a pretty oily chocolate concoction for it to move smoothly through that little. It's basically just like it has like a little spiral spinning in a tube so that it like, you know, creates a lift and that it spills out from the top. But we had a lot of misadventures with that chocolate fountain because the texture is so temperamental. And if the chocolate was not exactly liquid but viscous enough, it would just like create these very unappetizing like little like globs of chocolate. Oh, like gross. Like kind of erupting from it. So anyway, that definitely, it is possible to have an unappetizing chocolate fountain. Fun fact. So I can definitely imagine being deeply turned off of chocolate by having to shovel a bunch of sludge mixed with asphalt.
Yeah, I sort of personally referenced the summer that I worked at an ice cream shop and then it really ruined it for quite some time. It just gets everywhere.
Yeah. But luckily, currently, the three of us all enjoy a career where we can just enjoy chocolate recreationally.
That is true. Privilege.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Speaking of people who don't enjoy chocolate, of course, reading about
chocolate retrospect.
What was that?
Biggest red flag. As my worst ex hated chocolate. In retrospect, biggest red flag. Don't trust people who don't like chocolate. Bad sign.
Well, I doubt your ex was the actor who played Augustus in the original Charlie and the Chocolate
Factory. No, but honestly, like, some similarities, for sure.
But I was, after reading about these two separate chocolate accidents, I was reading, I was curious what that chocolate river like on the film set was actually made of, and I think they definitely pushed some like child safety laws there, because
I've heard that about that movie in general.
I think so. We should do an investigation on that. But I guess the river was just a giant like trough that they dug out and filled with like kind of like tainted water. So definitely not chocolate. It was just dirty water. And they actually put this young actor in it. He had to swim around. He had to like be filled, like he was stuck in a pipe that was filled up to his head with water. And I guess like the cast and crew would just also dump trash in this river, like coffee grounds and stuff, because it was already dirty. And they just like never cleaned it and made him like, you know, have his little crisis chocolate factory.
That's
crisis
nasty.
In it. So that's he's done a few interviews about it and he seems traumatized by all that.
Yes. Sympathy for Augustus.
All right. We're going to take a quick break and then we'll be back with more facts.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that. And find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps, because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though most of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science, with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill discuss how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. The veteran biotech executive also shares his thoughts on how to keep things innovative at a company that's been around since the 1860s. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can find this episode and many more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, we're back. And Corinne, I'm going to talk about some scrubbing.
I'm going to talk about some scrubbing. Yes. This story, as we said before, is one of the reasons that we were so into bringing back the oops becomes messy issue. This is written by one of our regular PopSci feature contributors, a fellow named Ryan Bradley, who just brings us the most charming stories that are like deeply scientific that you just can't get anywhere else. It's just like I don't know where he finds this stuff, but it's incredible. Here we go. So there's a very unusual assembly line process that happens in a lab at the University of California at Santa Barbara, specifically at their Marine Science Institute. And in this lab, grad students stand at their lab benches and they've got in front of them these sort of spherical, globular, orangish, yellowish things that are literally covered in crud. And what these grad students do is they take these spherish shaped things and they unspool them. And when they unspool them, they sort of become like a weird plastic fishnet stocking. And it's covered in gunk. So they take this stocking and they put it over a lab tray and they scrape the gunk off. And then they rinse the stocking, they hang it dry, and then they ball it back up again and they zip tie it together to another one. And then it heads back out into the ocean to get more gunk. Now, the gunk in question on these little tufted, floofy, cushy ball things is plankton. And specifically, they're larvae from mussels, which settle on their surface during weeks that they're spent like out at sea, bolted to rocks on the ocean floor. Now, this odd procedure over time has become really central to researching ocean plankton, specifically over the last couple decades. So plankton collectively are the small organisms that get carried around in the tides and on currents, right? They're the ocean life that aren't fish, right? They don't really swim on their own. And they settle on things and they move with the tides. And the larvae of mussels and barnacles are part of the animal type of plankton, the zooplankton. And these critters are, you know, often really are a really good food source for ocean dwellers, right? Like krill is a type of plankton, and krill is, as we know, is what baleen whales eat. They're also really crucial because they're a big source of oceanic data for marine scientists, because plankton are very sensitive creatures. So even the smallest changes in ocean or water temperature, acidity, salinity, whatever nutrients are floating around in the water, have a massive impact on their populations. And so we see shifts in these balances manifest in various ways, probably the one that we're most used to in our current climactic situation would be the red tides, right? The algae blooms. Like those are the plankton signaling that something is very, very wrong here. So the tricky thing about all of this is that in order to really study these shifts and understand the relationships between the various types of plankton and the health of the oceans and our other waterways, is you have to count them. And they're like really small and you need to get a lot of them to get a good sample. So this was the problem that was really bugging a marine biologist at Oregon State University named Bruce Menge. And it was really bugging him in the late 80s. He needed a way to gather really big samples of both barnacle and mussel larvae so he could count them. Barnacles were kind of the easy part. You know, we've all seen enough like pirate ship movies to know that these things really just collect en masse on like slick surfaces like boat hulls. So he was able to create substrates, like a medium to collect barnacle larvae out of boat decking. That was really super easy. Mussel larvae, though, was really, really tricky because what they naturally settle on are these like fibrous strands of green algaes that kind of look like koosh balls, or they grab onto, you know, the beards of other mussels and they kind of nestle on top of one another. So what he was looking for was some sort of standardized surface, right? Like what's the boat decking of mussel larvae that he could attach and that would reliably be able to replicate that type of same collection surface again and again and again, right? He was looking for something that he could control. So
aren't
he was
we all?
Aren't we all? I just want to feel like I'm in control of just one
something.
Thing.
One thing.
Just anything. But in this instance, like, yeah, it is a very philosophical notion out of control, but it is also like fundamental to doing good science, right? So he was wandering around a grocery store and he was in the kitchen supplies and cleaning aisle and he saw this reddish, orangish, yellowish, fibrous sponge thing, and it was woven and it was tufted. It was called the tuffy. So he thought, this might work. So he bought a few and he screwed them to some rocks in the ocean and kept checking on them. And over time, over a few weeks, the larvae began to settle. And so he bought more. And then he bought more. And it kept working and it became widespread. Before too long, this became the way for marine biologists to collect these samples and do their population studies. Dozens of studies over the intervening decades relied on this kitchen sponge. Marine biologists were buying them by the crate. They could not get enough. And it wasn't just that it worked in the Pacific Northwest where Menge was. It worked, you know, there's studies that were done off the coasts of New Zealand, off the coasts of Chile, in the Atlantic, in the Pacific. This was just, they were so into it. It was perfect. It was what they had never known that they always needed. The thing about the tuffy is that whether or not it's actually good at its primary function is a matter of a little bit of debate. Some people really think it's the absolute perfect thing for scrubbing your cast iron without, you know, scrubbing your nice oil-slicked nonstick coating off of it. But just generally, as a kitchen scrubber, like, people were sort of like, meh to this is not great. So that sort of helps explain what happened next, which is the Clorox company, who's not the original owners of the Tuffy sponge, but became its producers through acquisition, discontinued it. And they replaced it with a similar but totally not quite exactly the same sponge with a different weave, a different color. There were other changes. Suffice it to say, it was just wrong. And folks, Tuffy devotees, people who loved it for their cast iron scouring, but more notably, marine biologists started just stockpiling these things. They were buying them on eBay for many, many, many times their grocery store price as precious sponges. And researchers like Jennifer Cassell, whose lab at UC Davis is now doing this unfurling and refurling and cleaning and scraping and bundling procedure with the Tuffies, tried a bunch of alternatives. And she thought about trying some others, but then she stopped herself because she realized that if she changed their collection medium after all this time, after all these studies, that's a problem, right? It's not just because she loved the Tuffy. It was because all of a sudden she had created a new variable that would really, really bork their data. And she was already okay with the reusing thing, because when she took a step back, and Ryan goes into this in the story, when she took a step back and thought about it, the fact of, like, marine scientists specifically making plastic waste just didn't really feel super good. So the fact that, like, they were using Tuffies initially and then discarding them just gave her the icks.
Sure.
So good on her for instituting the reuse process before she absolutely had to. But yeah, just generally, it was, like, not good, you know, so they're continuing to do that. Bruce Menge, meanwhile, instead of trying to make use of Tuffies that are currently in the field, he decided that he was going to look back at patterns in the data that he gathered in the years that he did have Tuffies out in the field, to really look back at what the plankton could be telling us, right? He was very curious. So we know that the plankton express what's happening in the oceans right now, right? At a given moment. But he wonders, and it seems that he's probably right in a lot of ways, that the plankton are actually bellwethers for what's going on in the ecosystem that we can't even see yet, right? Because if we remember that they don't move of their own volition, they move with the currents, right? They're circulating through the system. So any shifts that they're seeing, even if they're subtle, might be indicators of some nasty stuff about to come down the line, right? Like ocean heat waves, which are now becoming more and more common. So small or even rapid changes in ocean temperatures or acidity, like, before they happen, like, looking at old data gathered with the Tuffies can help us really understand these things. And these are just marine biology, despite the fact that the Tuffy doesn't exist, right, is very much not done with it. Not, like, at all. So that's the Tuffy, right? And the Tuffy is so charming, and it's a delightful little object when you see it in the magazine. It's colorful and it's vibrant and it looks like a piece of coral. I totally get it. Like, mussel larvae. I see you. I understand. It's a very attractive sponge, as such a thing can be. But it's also not the only example of, like, scientists really truly relying on something that was not intended for them at all, which is a very, as we know from the Tuffy, a pretty dangerous business to get into. A couple of my favorites, I'm glad you asked. The Victoria's Secret Amber Romance scent is very popular because it is evidently an extremely good insect repellent.
Interesting.
Interesting. I can't remember that one. I remember Dream Angels. I have no idea what Amber Romance smells like.
Yeah, I don't. I have no idea. That must make fieldwork more interesting, especially because, like, I don't know. I feel like you're pretty – you're kind of at your stinkiest doing fieldwork because of, like, the manual labor of being out there and also generally, like, not a situation where you can shower as much as you usually do. So I feel like that plus a Victoria's Secret perfume must kind of be I don't think that smells good, probably.
No. And the thing is, not to, like, be disparaging against scents that are marketed towards teens and tweens who frequent malls, but, you know, I'd imagine I probably don't like Amber Romance to begin with.
Yeah.
And I've also had experiences of people, like, opening those very pungent hand sanitizers from Bath and Body Works, and then it just creates this mutant funk. So I hear exactly what you're saying.
Was it the scent in itself, or did they mix it with other things for the repellent?
As far as I know, it's just the scent itself. And who knows, maybe they did figure it out by accident, right? Like, maybe it was somebody taking, like, a French shower when they were out doing field work, just, like, spritzing on some stuff to make it better. And they went, wait, I'm not getting bitten. Cool. Or the bugs are so repulsed by the combination of body odor and Amber Romance. But and you see other things like sifting bones with tea strainers, or there's a certain type of waterproof paper that Cassell's lab used for note-taking that was made by Xerox, and then Xerox changed the paper, and she was like, "Ah, crap." Because they just, like, it's not that research ground to a halt, but they, like, stopped being able to, like, make notes the way that they thought the way that they needed to, because, like, they needed their waterproof paper. But it's just, it's an interesting thing to think about, that you put science sort of in the crosshairs of the whims of, like, consumer desire.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to change something once you've started using it. And there are whole economic theories about this that we go into in the piece, but we do not have to go into right now because I will not do them justice. But yeah, at the end of the day, we always have the Tuffy.
I want to be a Tuffy. I just want to catch plankton and waves and let that be my
Sounds chill.
It sounds like a pretty nice life.
To live.
Until they, like, stretch you out and start scraping things off of you.
Okay.
And no, I'll tap out nice before too. That. It's what I go to, like, Korean spas for. So
truth. Basically what, truth.
What
fair.
Happens there. So
it's a good life for a Tuffy.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with one more messy fact.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, we're back, and I'm going to talk about some space poop. I've always been interested in stories about poop. I don't know why. I think when I was working at the Washington Post, I realized people would get really, really up in arms about such a newspaper of record having a story about poop science. And so that just encouraged me to write about it even more. And now here I am, some years later, still writing about poops. So recently, some listeners may have seen trailers or even the movie itself. This movie came out called Moonfall. It's very silly. Action adventure movie involving the moon coming to us. it's real romp. Definitely recommend it if you like films that are not objectively like good, shall we say, but it's a lot of fun. And Mika McKinnon, who's a geologist and disaster researcher who does science consulting for film and TV, which is just such a cool side hustle. She reached out to me being like, you know, I'm doing the press junket for this and I'm really concerned that maybe no one's going to ask me about the fact that one of the characters, when he finds out unexpectedly that he's going into space, says he has irritable bowel syndrome. And I was like, Mika, you're right. I am the person for that story. I absolutely want to talk to you and NASA about how you handle having IBS or just any poop problems in space. Because I was aware that pooping in space is kind of an ordeal. Even today with modern technology, it is done with the assistance of vacuum pressure, because the thing is that for most of us, particularly if we are relatively able-bodied, going to the bathroom, while it may not always be pleasant, is pretty straightforward. Like the stuff comes out of you and gravity takes it into the toilet, right?
Bless gravity. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, gravity. The thing is, there's no gravity on the International Space Station, just to name one example of a place you might be in space. And so even with modern technology, like going to the bathroom on the ISS involves like a vacuum funnel that you put on your person so that it can draw away the stuff that gravity usually takes care of plunking into the toilet for us. So I knew that, and I knew that even that was like a big advance, and that historically things have been more difficult. For example, on the Apollo 10 transcripts, which I read for the first time because I was pre-writing an obituary for a very famous astronaut. It's a very awkward rite of passage. If you work at a big newspaper, they have you write up an obituary for someone who is not sick, not dead, just there's some concern that they might croak sometime in the next 5 years. And so I had to call up people and be like, obviously this will never run. This person you love very much will live forever. But supposing they died, what would you want me to say about them? And so I was reading some Apollo transcripts, and in Apollo 10, you will find, and I'm looking at this right now, you can see it online. I will link to it on popsci.com/weird because everything is recorded. There are references to a floating turd, and in fact, several floating turds, because on Apollo 10, poop escaped. There were free floating poops, multiple instances of that. And so I'll just read some choice quotes, but again, you can examine this for yourself, see the primary documentation. Someone says, "Have you got the turd?" And someone else says, "You got a big mess. People are mad at you, and I don't blame them. I don't care." Dadgum, I still think it's a little funny. First crap around the sun. The first free crap in space. I'm skipping around, just to be clear. These are multiple.
Did they redact the names? Speaking.
What?
Did they redact the names?
So they're labeled by like their role. on the crew.
So it's figure outable. You can
see who's who, but then also, like, this is a transcript from a recording from, like, the 60s. So I think there are, in a couple instances, it's maybe a little dubious who was actually talking. But you can suss it out if you so choose. I am just not outing anyone at this moment.
I was just going to say that I very much am charmed and appreciate the, like, okay for public consumption, earnest G-rated swearing.
Yeah, they do occasionally really swear, but they clearly, given the era and the military background of everyone involved, they clearly, like, make an effort to do more dadgum and darn it than anything else. There's that. Then later, in the middle, they're talking about, you know, being in space. They're doing very serious things. Who did it? Who did what? What? Who did it? Where did that come from? Give me a napkin quick. There's a turd floating through the air. I didn't do it. It ain't one of mine. I don't think it's one of mine. Mine was a little more sticky than that. Throw that away. God almighty. Nothing. That's enough for me. Nice going there. No more turds are going to fit in there. So that's them dealing with the waste compartment.
How is this not a movie or a video game at this point?
It should have been one. Absolutely.
A video game, though. Oh, my God.
And then, one more time later on in the transcript, again, when they're trying to deal with being in space, suddenly they're in the middle of talking to, like, mission control, and then they're like, here's another goddamn turd. What's the matter with you guys? Someone says, well, babe, if it was me, I sure would know I was shitting on the floor. It was just floating around. And so they're talking about the consistency. And they're just like, no one's owning up to the poop. I was talking to Joseph Schmidt, who's a flight surgeon at NASA, which basically means, like, he is the physician for astronauts, and he's been assigned to several space missions. So, like, it's his job to make sure people are generally healthy and that they're, like, prepared for any health problems they might face while in space. And then he just kind of works with, like, coaching them through the process of acclimating, all of that. And so he and I were chatting about the turd transcripts. He was like, yeah, you might, yeah, you know, there's actually, like, there was a poop incident. And I'm like, I know, man, I've read the Apollo 10 transcripts. It's not my first space poop rodeo. And here's the thing, is that, despite the indignation of the astronauts being like, how is this possible? Who done it? It was actually, like, very understandable for this to occur, because the way that astronauts pooped during the Apollo missions was that they had these baggies that had, like, sticky stuff around the edge. So you literally stuck the baggie to your butt, and then they had the issue of, like, there was no gravity to make stuff come away. So they added, like, an extra little, like, tab in the plastic so that you could manually manipulate things and get everything down into the bag. And then you would seal it, and it would go into that compartment that they were talking about, like, not being able to hold more poop. And so if a sticky bag came undone, either while you were doing your business or after you had tried to dispose of it, then it would just be freeborn. It would be the first free poop in space, as they said. So this probably, like, happened, you know, hopefully not every Apollo mission, but, like, it was definitely on the list of things that could go wrong. High on the list, I would say. These days, there are, like, the Soyuz does have, like, a little suction toilet, but it is, like, as unpleasant as the experience sounds on the ISS, it is, like, a smaller facility when you're, you know, launching up. So they do offer an enema before launching, and I wasn't told how frequently astronauts take them up on that, but I would say probably most do, because you really just, like, you want to avoid needing to go to the bathroom. And in fact, it's a problem where the position you're in when you're launching, where kind of like your feet are above your heart, you get a lot of fluid pooling, which makes your kidneys, you know, get to work, and that makes you need to pee. And so a lot of people, like, they don't want to be hydrating because they don't want to have to pee so much when they're in transit. And, you know, flight surgeons like Joe really have to, like, fight against that, because you don't want people getting woozy and dehydrated on their way to frickin' space. But you are basically peeing into, like, a diaper. They call them, like, maximum absorbency garments, which is a very nice way of saying a diaper. And that is an improvement over, like, the pee condoms that used to be standard. It's what it sounds like, and you peed into it. And once they had to kind of figure out absorbent garments as an option for people who do not have penises, everyone was like, okay, but that's better than wearing a rubber pee tube the whole time. So circling back to my initial inspiration, as a woman of a certain ethnic background, I have tummy problems. And I have always wondered, well, now I wonder, what happens if you have an upset tummy in space. And the thing is that you're sharing this tiny vacuum-powered toilet with, like, anywhere from 6 to, like, a dozen-ish people. And everything is really rigidly scheduled because everything has to be on the space station. Like, you just – there's no room for lollygagging about. And so, you know, my thinking was, like, what if you don't – what if your business doesn't happen on schedule? What if your business happens frequently and uncomfortably? And the takeaway is that, like, while everything is scheduled, there is, like, kind of gray space, and you can always choose to hurry up a task so that you have more free time to use the bathroom. So the answer is kind of, if you need to use the bathroom a lot, if that's something you know about yourself, you just need to learn to, like, work more efficiently so that no one will miss you while you go off to the ISS toilet. Of course, you still need to negotiate the use of that toilet with the people you are stuck in orbit with. So Joe from NASA did tell me that, like, everybody has trouble adjusting. So, like, the whole protocol for when you first go to space and every time you go back involves a lot of, like, first of all, coaching on what it's going to be like to use the toilet, and also, like, a diet designed to help keep you regular. They're really obviously paying attention to all of your vital signs. So to me, the takeaway was kind of, like, it's almost simpler if you have an existing issue that you're aware of, because then they can work really hard to, like, mitigate your symptoms as much as humanly possible while you're on the ground. And a lot of people who have never had an issue will, like, get up into space and be, like, puking or having some other issue for several days. And so, kind of, like, the fewer surprises there are, the better. Also, kind of my takeaway in this chat with the NASA flight surgeon was, like, maybe everybody with IBS should become an astronaut so that they get this much medical attention. Maybe all of their problems would go away. Maybe that's how healthcare should work. But anyway, I learned a lot about pooping in space, and I will link to the full story in the article for this episode on popsci.com/weird. But obviously the highlight was the free floating turd on Apollo 10, and everything else is just set dressing. And I know that, but hopefully you learned something.
Oh, I have so many thoughts. Like, when we were talking about the enemas, all I was thinking was, like, your body's stress response, right? Like, when you have an adrenaline surge, right? Poop in your pants is, like, literally just a thing that happens.
Sure. Absolutely.
Right? So I couldn't imagine saying no to the enema.
Yeah, no, that. Like, I think you, like, look, all things considered, you want an empty tank when you set out for space.
Word.
That's my advice to anyone about to head up to ISS for the first time. But yeah, I think, like, you know, it's so interesting to think about the way NASA and other space agencies troubleshoot on ISS because, like, I mean, talking to this flight surgeon, he was like, I can't just, like, write a prescription and have them send it up. Like, yes, there are cargo deliveries, but they are not frequent and space is at a premium. You know, it's takes a lot of energy to send stuff up into space. So, again, it's like it's actually kind of better if it's like we know you have this issue and like we have all these months to get to know your body on Earth and like figure out what medications really help. And then you go up with all that stuff. And if someone has a problem that has not been anticipated, it's, you know, I mean, that's where you get the, like Apollo 13 scene where they're like taping the air filters onto the wrong shaped hole. You imagine that, but a bunch of doctors try to figure out how to get you to stop pooping. But anyway, they're prepared for many eventualities. One thing that Joe said that I really liked was that he learned in his medical training that people who are quote unquote normal just haven't been evaluated closely enough and that, like, you know, there is no normal human. Everybody has some issue or another, which I think is very true and a little bit poignant and also, you know, definitely a good philosophy for a NASA flight surgeon to have because they really have to, like, imagine so many ways that things could go wrong with your body and try to prep for them. So all of that is to say, if you dream of going to the stars and you're anxious because you have IBS, I got news for you. Keep dreaming big, kid, because it's in reach.
Beautiful. But that does make me think that as more everyday people go into space, like you still go through some, you go through many health checks and like physical training, but they're just going to have to, you know, be more open to like people with different conditions, like going mm-hmm. up there and totally. They'll have to, and when I say they, I don't just mean NASA, but like some of these commercial space companies, they're going to have to troubleshoot like technologies and medications and such that are going to help people, you know, make that couple hour ride. So that's kind of exciting. It's like when like women started going to space, they had to like change up a lot of things about spacesuits and
find something other than a pee condom.
There you go. But it's also, it's like really nice to think about how much space agencies and space flight and the people who are screening people who go into space, right? How far we've evolved since the Mercury astronauts who were all held up as these like peak perfect specimens of everything. And these are like absolutely this is what normal is. This is the epitome. And now we're just like,
that's what the standards were based on, those
exactly
hardy white men. And you know mm-hmm. what? They still pooped their pants in space. They still did that.
And one of the Mercury astronauts pissed in his suit on the launch pad, right? It's just like, this is what happens.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, one thing that we talked about, that I talked about with the NASA flight surgeon was that there is also, it's like, you know, there are, if you have a health problem that they don't feel confident about being able to manage in space, you know, that may disqualify you. And you know, I don't think I would want to be a person with a health problem that couldn't be managed in space and be in space. It's a very uncomfortable place to be. That being said, he did say that, like, if you're going up to ISS as, like, you know, like a cultural visitor, you know, which does happen, like, there are definitely people who are not part of the crew who go up, or especially back during the shuttle program, that was pretty common. There would be people just kind of along for the ride. And in that instance, the threshold kind of changes because it's just like, are you going to be like at risk of, are you going to be in danger if we send you to space? Because, like, an astronaut, they do kind of, they have duties to fulfill. So they want to make sure you're going to be able to keep working fairly nominally. But if you're just going to visit, they're like, I mean, you know, as long as you don't mind having to poop that much, that's fine by us, man. Like,
we'll figure it out.
That's how
dude.
You want to spend your week in space. Go for it. And I think there will be a lot of that with commercial spaceflight. I think, like, you know, there will be a lot of being like, we haven't made this experience comfortable for you, but you can still do it if you wanna.
Everybody poops.
Yeah, everybody poops, including in space. Hopefully. Oh, yeah, constipation is more of an issue. I didn't even get into that. You got to read about that on popside.com/weird. So, anyway, what was the weirdest thing we learned this week? I'm going to vote for the chocolate river. Well, not the chocolate river. I'm not saying that learning about Willy Wonka was the weirdest thing I learned this week. I'm saying the quickly hardening, perfectly tempered chocolate catastrophe is pretty delightful.
It truly is. And it's just, again, I think I'm so, and I encourage everybody to look at this and we'll link to it. Like, the image is so, like, it just looks like blacktop. Like, what happened? It's a chocolate road. I'm also team chocolate road. Like, I think the space poop was the funniest thing I heard this week.
Thank you.
But the chocolate takes the weird.
I will have to say Tuffy just because it's so niche and weird and wonderful and unexpected. But also I've been hearing Corinne talk about that story for like a while. So
guess what? It might be over. You might not have to hear me talk about it anymore. Except that's also a lie.
All right. So listeners, definitely check out our latest issue. You can find links to it on popsci.com. And if you're an Apple News subscriber, it'll already be in your feed, and you should definitely check it out. Congratulations to Pravita on the most delicious take on the messy theme.
Go chocolate. Stop listening to this podcast if you don't like chocolate.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Get out. Yeah.
But it is the perfect mess to revel in.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's what it's all about.
The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week is a Popular Science podcast. We're available on all major podcast platforms, so subscribe wherever you're listening now. And if you like what you hear, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps other weirdos find the show. For more information on the stories you heard in this episode, come find us at popsci.com/weird. You can buy our merch, including Weirdest Thing t-shirts, tote bags, and mugs, at popsci.threadless.com. The show is produced by all of our hosts, including me, Rachel Feltman, with editing and audio engineering by Jess Bodie. Our theme music is by Billy Cadden. If you have questions, suggestions, or weird stories to share, tweet us at @weirdest_thing. Thanks for listening, weirdos.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps, because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.